Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So as Albert mentioned, I've recently returned from pilgrimage in India, as some of the others of you here have done. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that, but to use it as a way of speaking to a topic which someone asked me to speak about tonight. And that is, they said, I'm always saying to contemplate cause and effect in daily life. And they asked me to talk about that. So I'm going to use the pilgrimage to illustrate some aspects of how we contemplate cause and effect. Why we contemplate cause and effect in our daily life is to see how our thoughts and our emotions, our reactions, our attitudes, which lead on to our speech and our behaviour, don't arise out of nowhere. They arise out of our past, and they are affected by what's going on in the present. One thing gives rise to another. This is the cause and effect. Something is the cause and something is the effect. And we talk about conditioning in Buddhism. We talk about things being conditionally arisen, produced. That is, something arises because of something else. And these two things are related to each other. One thing is the condition for the other. This wouldn't arise without that. Because of this, that arises. Things are connected. Things can be both conditioned and conditioning. So, for example, a particular attitude is produced because of our past experience, our home life, what we've been taught at school, what kind of experience we've had, what our cultural background is, how old we are. All of those things produce a particular kind of reaction or attitude towards a situation, and then that produced reaction, when we act on it, becomes a new cause. First it was the effect, and then it becomes the cause. And we are trying to look at this so that we can start to understand what the Buddha was talking about when he talked about anatta, non-self. The teaching that says that all of our thoughts, all of our ideas, all of our ideas about who we are can be traced back to a cause and effect relationship. They don't arise out of nowhere. They're not things which are unchanging, and they're not things which stay the same forever. And that is why it's very important that we start to look at our reactions, our ideas, our attitudes, our behaviour patterns in terms of cause and effect, so we can start to see these layers upon layers of conditioning. Because some of the conditioning we have is out of date. It's no longer useful. It's no longer true. It's no longer relevant. Some of the conditioning we have is very valid, helpful, allows us to live peacefully in this world now, allows us to get on with our life and do the things we need to do. And the path of practice is to help us to discriminate between which are the ones which are useful and we need to keep and we need to develop, and which are the ones which are no longer useful and we need to let go. To let go is not so easy. We have to really understand that whatever it is we're hanging on to is no longer useful or profitable for us, and only then are we willing to let go of some of our very tightly held ideas about ourselves or others. Now, I'd like to illustrate this by talking about the pilgrimage, and particularly to talk about expectations, because expectations are both conditioned by what we've experienced in the past, what people have told us, what we've read, what we think about who we are. And our expectations also condition our experience in this moment. And when we have very strong expectations, we're always judging what's happening to us, whether it's right or wrong, not according to how it is in itself, but how it fits into our expectations. So the judgmental mind comes up with expectations. Shoulds. It should be like this. This is wrong. If it's not the way we expect it, very often expectations blind us to the actual experience, because we are trying to fit the experience into our preconceived idea of what it should be. Expectations are conditioned, and they also condition the present moment. They can be gross or they can be subtle, and I hope through my illustrations you'll be able to see what I'm talking about. So going on pilgrimage, for those of you who may not be familiar, is something which happens in all religious traditions, going to visit the places associated with the teacher, with episodes from the life of the teacher, or episodes from the life of the disciples of the teacher, going to visit places of historical connection to the teacher, going with a heart of faith, going with a strong confidence that this teacher is the one who offers the clearest and best explanation for life and how to live it skillfully. Even in the time of the Buddha encouraged his disciples to go to the place where he was born, where he attained enlightenment, where he gave the first teaching, and where he passed away. And these are the four places which Buddhist pilgrims go to visit: Lumbini, where the Buddha was born; Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha attained enlightenment; Sarnath, or as it was known in the time of the Buddha, Isipatana, where he preached the first sermon and the first disciple was able to understand the teaching and realize the first stage on the path to enlightenment; and the place where the Buddha passed away, Kusinaga. And there are other places associated with the life of the Buddha, like Sarvati, where the Buddha spent 19 rains retreats and gave many powerful, important teachings. So that's another place that we visit. There are various other places on the usual pilgrimage itinerary. And The reason why we go is not only because we have faith, but because we have expectations. We expect that we're going to get something out of it, that it's going to be a positive experience. And very often we are expecting that it's going to somehow contribute to our spiritual growth. Sometimes people go with a very strong faith in the Buddha as the teacher and the Dharma as his teaching and the Sangha, those who practice according to the Buddha's instructions. And so when they go with that very strong faith, there's this anticipation of a joyful connection with the places where the Buddha lived and taught. Sometimes people go wanting to firm up their faith. They may have found the Buddha's teaching helpful, and they like the direction that their life is heading in now that they've started to practice, but they're still not really sure. They still feel maybe there's something missing. They haven't really gotten into it like other people they see. And so they go on pilgrimage hoping that it's going to deepen their connection with the teaching, that they're going to feel the energy, as people talk about, when they go to the holy places where the Buddha lived and practiced. So there's that kind of expectation. And you can see that to have that kind of expectation comes out of our experience so far. It comes out of our experience of connection to the teaching. It comes out of our experience of what we've gained from the teaching. And it has created this expectation of what's going to come next. And so when we embark on the pilgrimage, these expectations are there, but we may not be consciously aware of them. We may not have thought about it. We may not have really articulated it to ourselves. We don't know that we're setting up a set of conditions which, in order for this pilgrimage to be right, successful, good, have to be fulfilled. This is not just about the pilgrimage. This is what we do with life all the time. I'm just using the pilgrimage experience to try to illustrate. Now, if we're trying to contemplate cause and effect in our daily life, we would be taking some time when we're getting ready for pilgrimage to consider what's making me go on this. It takes a lot of organisation, costs a lot of money. I have to leave behind things that I'm comfortable with, familiar with. What is it that is propelling me to do this? And we might be aware of some of those expectations that we're setting up in our mind. And just to be aware of them can be helpful to see what has produced the speech and behaviour necessary to put ourselves on that plane, to put ourselves on that bus. Very often when we have expectations, it's a way of trying to make a situation safe. We know what to expect. We do our research. We know what it's like. We know how to prepare. And in preparing and knowing, we hope that we'll be able to remove any of the difficulties from the situation, that we'll be able to smooth out the rough bits. Sometimes we have that expectation. Or we have an expectation that someone else is going to do that for us. The person who's leading the trip, or the Sangha who are on the trip, or the husband or the wife or the friend or whoever it is that's coming with us. It's their job to make sure that everything goes well for me. Just to be aware of that can be helpful so that we're not putting out these unrealistic expectations onto others. Because what happens when we go on pilgrimage, going to India, is that no matter how well prepared we are, and no matter how much we think we've got it covered, there's always going to be unexpected things that come up, that happen. It's like that in life generally. It's like that even if you go to a very orderly place, a very regimented place. But particularly when you go to India, anything can happen. And so having this set of expectations that all troubles have been taken care of because we've planned so well, that expectation can set us up for a lot of disappointment. And when we have disappointment, then we like to find someone to blame. And so that's how expectation is conditioned, and then it becomes a conditioning factor. Hey, that's not supposed to happen. You should such and such. And instead of being with the situation as this is how it is now, what do we need to do to address this situation? We get into shoulds, blame, and sometimes lots of anger. That didn't happen to anyone on our pilgrimage, I must say. But this is what happens when we set up an expectation of how things should be. One of the expectations we have when we go to these holy places is already that it's holy. That is already an assumption. What does it mean that a place is holy? If you contemplate that most of the places that are holy to Buddhism are populated by people who are non-Buddhist, do you think that they're holy to those place, to those people? You go to some of the places and the Buddhists are the pilgrims coming through, but they're not the people who live there. They're not the people who are there every day. They're not the people who have to make their livelihood. They're not the people who have to survive there. And so even if you go to Bodh Gaya, which is the place where the Buddha became enlightened, and you go there with the expectation, this is the holiest place in Buddhism. You go there and you find that many, many people are living there, making their livelihood there, coming and going there, who have no sense that this is a holy place at all. And even the people who go there as pilgrims, they're so different. We're coming from our particular background, Theravada tradition of Thailand, Sri Lanka, Burma, all the various Theravada countries. And you go to Bodh Gaya and you find that there are Buddhists from all different countries, all different backgrounds, and all of them have their particular form of Buddhism. Which one is right? Now, if we go along with the expectation, my Buddhism, my pilgrimage, my Buddha, my Bodh Gaya, the right way of chanting, the right way of making offerings, the right way of doing this, the right way of doing that, then we set ourselves up for suffering. Because when we get to the temple, which is the focal point, we find hundreds, if not thousands of people, all of us Buddhists, doing things in different ways. And because it's physically congested, it's almost a competition to see who can have their chant heard, who can do their puja, who's got a space to sit down and do the meditation the way they think that it should be done. And all of the ideas of my space. I need this much space. If I'm going to sit here and meditate, I want everyone to stay at least a meter away from me while I meditate. And if I'm going to do my chanting, I expect at least that the people who are around me will be quiet while I chant, not carry on conversation or chant in their own style, chant over the top of me. My, gets stepped on a lot of the times there. And so one has to really open one's mind, open one's heart to the fact that everyone's style of chanting is perfect. Everyone's style of puja is just right. Everyone's way of walking or sitting or doing is just as it should be. Otherwise, it can become, instead of my visit to the holiest place in Buddhism, my chance to sit under the tree where the Buddha became enlightened, my chance to feel the power of that place, it can become a place of misery. Not only from the mosquitoes, not only from the dogs, not only from the other people who are within the temple complex. People who've been there are all smiling because, you know, that's what it's like. Not only from the people within the temple complex, right outside the wall, you have a Muslim mosque calling the faithful to prayer five times a day. So you go down to the temple early in the morning, 4 o'clock, before the noise. There's no such thing before the noise, an expectation. You go down there, you sit, and then you hear the imam. He's also gotten up early because he wants to make sure he calls the faithful in the early part of the day. And so you're not only dealing with all the other Buddhist pilgrims who are there, you're dealing with people from different religions and people who are just having fun right outside the wall of the temple. So the idea of how it should be can become an obstacle to being at peace with how it is. And there are so many wonderful things to see. There are a lot of Tibetan pilgrims, Tibetan refugees who live in very poor conditions in Bodh Gaya, all around that area. And they come and perform their full body prostrations all around the temple area, some of them on the same spot, hundreds of prostrations throughout the day from morning till night, and others of them all around the temple precincts, all around the area. And it's very inspiring, but it can also be, hey, I was there first and now someone's come and done their prostration right where I was about to step, or right where I was about to sit. And how can I open up to that? Hey, this is the holiest place and I'm on pilgrimage and I'm supposed to be a little bit holy on this pilgrimage. How do I do it? I have to open up to what's there, letting go of the expectations of how it should be. Now, this is a fairly gross example of what I was talking about, how expectations are conditioned and they're also conditioning. So if we're able to open up, if we're able to let go and be with things, then we can enjoy the whole panorama of what's going on. We can enjoy seeing people expressing their faith in different ways. But if we can't open up, and if we hang on to our expectations of how we want it to be, then it can be misery right throughout the whole day and night. Now, another set of expectations that we have is that in order for something to be nice, good, right, proper, as it should be, it needs to be pleasant. Unpleasant feeling is bad, or unpleasant feeling makes the situation bad. This is the gross level of my space, my Buddha, my whatever. But at a more subtle level, I had the experience in Bodh Gaya of really challenging this idea that things have to be pleasant in order to be perfect. While we were there, we had the opportunity to go on alms round. And this was an unexpected opportunity. We were travelling with Sister Sari from the Nuns Monastery and myself in the company of Achanyana, who many of you will know, and Achan Jundi from Thailand, and Achan Chandiko, who's spent time in Perth and who now is in New Zealand. And unexpectedly, Achan Chandiko said, "Well, I'd like to go on alms round. Anyone else like to come?" And having been already in India previously, I know what it's like if you are out on the street. It's not so easy to walk. You have to watch where you're going because there's all sorts of dirt on the pavement that we don't normally see here in Australia. Not only animal dirt, but human dirt, people blowing their nose on the floor all the time, refuse, all sorts of things. And it's not such a pleasant experience to be walking on all of that. Now, Achan Chandiko had been on alms round many times in Thailand. I'd been on alms round many times in Sri Lanka when I lived there. But for Sister Sari, who ordained here in Dharmasara, she'd never been on alms round before, except in the park here when we have our big occasions. So it was quite a challenge to accept to go on alms round, go barefoot, go through the streets, just with your alms bowl, silently, and if anyone wants to put food in the bowl, to allow them to do so. Walking for about an hour in the early morning. And as we walked out, there were all sorts of expectations in the mind. Yuck. Now, this is going to be a challenge. But also, this tremendous joy. This was walking on alms round, where the Buddha became enlightened. This was being an alms mendicant. Because although we were on pilgrimage with a group of our lay supporters, none of the Sangha were there because we had the means to be there ourselves. All of us had been invited through the generosity of others. And so although we were with this group of pilgrims, we were still alms mendicants. And so there was this tremendous joy at the prospect of going out and going on alms round. But there was also a bit of trepidation. What if people don't like us? What if people get angry with us? What if people don't give us anything? All of those thoughts going on in the mind. And expectations creating, ooh, or ah, or whatever. And so conditions become conditioning as we walked out. How do we walk, with a heart full of joy or with that trepidation? As we walked, it was very easy to be mindful because you really had to watch where each foot went. And as we got closer into the busy area, have to watch for vehicles, for animals, for people who are doing their morning ablutions while you're walking past, all those sorts of things. And it was a very good example of how something doesn't have to be pleasant to be joyful, uplifting and inspiring. Watching the mind through the whole of each arms round, it was easy to see that there were moments when the mind recoiled from what the foot just touched or where we had to walk past, the smells, the sights. And yet there was still this tremendous joy in the heart. And so it was very a powerful experience for cutting through that idea of something has to be pleasant in order for it to be good, in order for it to be right. There were aspects of unpleasantness, but there was also tremendous joy. And we were given more food than we could carry. We had a layman and a laywoman walking with us, carrying our excess, and we had enough food to feed everyone on the pilgrimage. So from the point of view of learning about the generosity and of people and the rewards of living this life, it was a very powerful experience. It was lovely to see people who didn't know about alms mendicants from this tradition. Many people who were going to the temple tried to offer us money, and when we said we don't accept money, they said, food? Yes, yes, food. So they would go away and buy something and come back and offer the food so that our alms bowls were literally overflowing. So this is mainly to point out that our expectations about what's good for us, these are conditioned, and we need to challenge those. We need to hold them up for examination. Sometimes the things that are easy, the things that we've been doing, and because we've been doing them like that forever, they've become easy. They really aren't that good for us. Just because it's pleasant, even, it tastes nice, it feels good, isn't necessarily really good for us. And the things that we find difficult, the things that are unpleasant, getting up early in the morning to meditate or sitting in meditation, may not be pleasant, but that doesn't mean that it's not good for us. These are more subtle forms of expectations that we have about experience. Pleasant is good, unpleasant is bad. And it's only when we start to look at our own experience in our daily life that we can really challenge that wrong understanding. Obviously, some things are unpleasant and not good for us, and some things are pleasant and good for us, but we have to learn to discriminate between which is which. Another set of expectations which were challenged in on the pilgrimage was the idea that problems belong to someone else when we're in a group, and they don't necessarily belong to me. This idea of where our connections with others begins and ends. And we notice in our ordinary life how we often set up barriers between ourselves and others, set up boundaries about how close we'll let people become to us, how involved we're going to get in other people's lives, trying to keep a safe distance from other people's troubles. And when we go on pilgrimage, there may be an expectation, a sense of, I'm going on pilgrimage for myself. This is something I want to do. I'm going maybe on my own or with my friends or with my partner, and this is my group. I'm a subgroup within the big group. But we're going to look after ourselves, and everyone else will just have to look after themselves. And of course, the longer you spend in a small group going through the sometimes trying experiences of travelling in India, the more difficult it becomes to keep those boundaries, because situations arise where we need each other We need each other's help. We need each other's smile. We need each other's look of it'll be okay. We need each other's reassurance. We need to look around and see something that's familiar, someone we know. And so those ideas about where my boundaries are and how much I'm going to get involved with you, how much effort I'm going to put into making it comfortable for you, these again are expectations which we set up and which we need to be flexible about. If we're not, we can find ourselves stewing, because we may be the very person who needs a little bit more help. We might be the very person who can offer a little bit of help at that time. And the situation that someone else finds themselves in could very easily be the situation that we're in next. I had a very interesting episode on the pilgrimage when someone in the group got very sick, and they were sick for a day or so, and then we were making a journey, a flight, and this person ended up having to be taken off the plane and hospitalised. And the whole episode was quite engaging for all of us, as you can imagine, that someone in our group should be ill, that they may not be able to continue with us. And the interesting part of the whole thing was at the end, when people had done all they could to help this person, and the decision was finally made that she was going to get off the plane and go and get some medical treatment. Now, two things happened. One was that the person who was leading the pilgrimage had to get off the plane with her to look after her, and there was this terrible sense of being abandoned. We were supposed to be looked after all the way from home to home, and here was our mum going and leaving us. How are we going to manage? And everyone on the pilgrimage was an adult, I might mention, but all of us felt that we were part of one big family by that time, and that our mum was about to abandon us. And could we manage without her? So that was very interesting to notice, how we'd all become so connected that when one person was leaving because they were sick, that was bad enough, but when our mum was leaving to look after her, that was even worse. And then, of course, there was a sense of relief. Well, at least this problem is over. Fortunately, we were having a short flight, and the person could be taken to hospital. It wasn't like they were going to be left in the middle of nowhere. They were being left in Mumbai, which is Bombay. So this is the end of our troubles. This was a bit of a glitch. Someone got so sick. We looked after them. Off they go. Problem ended. Now, the interesting thing that happened, and I'd like to just bring this up because this is our expectation of the problem's over now. First, there was the realization we were going to be on our own, and how are we going to cope? So how are we going to deal with that? But then the next thing that happened was that while the plane was on the tarmac waiting for the new passengers to come on board, security people came on board, and it's their procedure in India that they go through the plane and they check that all the luggage that's been carried on board as hand luggage actually has an owner still on the plane, so that people don't bring on explosives, the obvious one, take a short trip, get off the plane and leave the explosives on the plane. And as you might have heard, there were bombs recently in India. This is something that they're very conscious of. And of course, when that happened and the security person got on and they found an unclaimed briefcase on our plane. And the thought came into my mind, hey, the person who was sick and got off the plane might be the person who's going to be saved. And all the rest of us are stuck on this plane that's about to explode. Now, I said that to the person sitting next to me, and they had a look of shock, horror on their face, because that's not what they expected. The other person was having the problems, not us. And yet, here we were in perhaps an even worse situation. Now, as it turned out, they actually took that bag off the plane. But we were quite safe and continued on our journey. And our mother came back to us the next day, so we were even safer after that. But the expectation of who's having problems, the reality of anything can happen at any moment, the reality of change, the reality of death, this possibility being with the next breath. This is something that most of us never consider. It's an expectation that we're going to live, if not forever, that we're going to live at least till old age, or at least till Christmas, or at least till our grandkids grow up, or at least this is an expectation. No basis in reality. We can look at statistics and say that people's average age is 80-something, but that's statistics, it's not us. We don't know what our life expectancy is. And the Buddha said, to be in touch with reality, we need to be ready to die at any moment. And that kind of situation is a wonderful reminder that we're not. Hey, I'm getting off this plane. Hey, can't. The expectation that we're going to live that little bit longer. This is a very subtle expectation that we don't even ordinarily bring to mind. And in fact, we may not even like to be reminded that it's only an expectation that's conditioned and is also conditioning. If we think that we're going to die in the next moment, what will we do? If we think we've got forever, how do we live our life? When we start to observe just expectations generally, see the cause and effect relationship of them, little by little we're able to move from more gross, obvious expectations to start to question even these deeply held but rarely seen expectations. We start to see how they're affecting the way we live our life. This path of practice is to help us to wake up to what's really good for us, so that we can make the most of every day. So when we find that we are conditioned in a certain way and that conditioning is helpful, then to use it. When we find that we have attitudes, ideas, beliefs, emotional reactions that aren't helpful, then to do something about it, to change them, to let them go. And the whole of the path of practice is about developing the mind so that it's able to do that. Keeping precepts, limiting the kind of speech and behaviour that we engage in so that we consciously train ourselves not to harm ourselves or other beings. This not only produces a more peaceful mind, it helps us to see more clearly those areas where we do harm ourselves and others. To cultivate the mind, to be mindful, to pay attention to what's going on, moment by moment, but at least in a gross way when very strong reactions come up, not just to allow those reactions to steamroller us into our usual way of doing things, but to take a good look. Is this helpful or not? What do I need to do about them, these reactions? Where are they coming from? How can I change them? And to use meditation as the way of not only pacifying the mind, but allowing us to see more deeply into our conditioning, to see our expectations and see where they lead us. Do they lead us to fighting everyone who doesn't conform to our expectations, like being at Bodh Gaya and elbowing out the person who's trying to get to the shrine before you? Does it help us to expand and open up to allow everyone in? Does it help us to question whether we need everything to be pleasant in order for it to be good? And to help us to see those things which are driving us in our daily life, but which we're not even consciously aware of, our expectation that we're going to live forever. So these are the ways that we start to contemplate cause and effect in daily life. And I would certainly encourage any of you who have the opportunity to visit the holy places in India to do so, because it's a very powerful experience, not necessarily exactly what you expect, but it certainly touches people very deeply and opens us up to aspects of ourselves that we don't normally touch when we stay always within our comfort zone of habit patterns and the place that we're used to living, where we know what's going on, where we can read the situation and where we feel in charge. Tonight I'd especially like to dedicate the merits of this teaching to my teachers. First of all, my first teacher, Prakanti Palo, and to Venerable Ayakama, and to my preceptor, Venerable Pia Ratana. Today is my 21st anniversary of being ordained as a nun, and I was encouraged by a couple of people to mention that tonight so that people could rejoice. It's a cause for happiness. It's certainly a cause for joy for me. And those people that I mentioned are the teachers and the people who made it possible for me to ordain. So I'd really like to share the merits with all of them, and also wish for all of us that the merit of this teaching will help us all to attain Nibbana.